Welcome to The Archive Project.
I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for The Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we're devoting the entire hour to Liars League PDX, which is an offshoot of the original Liars League in London. There are also offshoots in Hong Kong and New York. Their premise is simple. The organizers pick a theme and invite writers to submit short fiction on that theme. The best of these stories are picked to be read by actors at a live event hosted by Literary Arts in our studio space in downtown Portland. Our host for the evening is Pamela Fleischman, who introduces both the writers and the actors. So I'll turn over our show to her. Here's Liars League PDX, recorded live at Literary Arts in May 2017.
Flash fiction, super short, creative, powerful, and deceptively complex narratives, 1,000 words or less. Tonight, we featured stories that fit all of those adjectives. To bring these stories to life, I would like to introduce you to our actors, Deanna Wells, Karen Moore, Megan Catherine, James Dixon, Kim Bogus, and Andre Barnes. Willpower, a noun, meaning self-control and determination. It sounds pretty easy. But we all know to exercise willpower over desire is anything but easy. We have all had that mental conversation with ourselves that usually starts with the line in the sand, "No, not today. I promised myself I would stop." Then inching one toe over the line. Well, looking won't hurt. But then renewing the resolution. No, I can't. Then the deep, dark truth. But I really want it. Willpower.
Secrets by Jean Rover. Keith awoke early that morning after sleeping in his gray Taurus by remote Quarry Lake. It had been a long, muddy drive. The sky was overcast and dull, making the water on the lake appear dreary. He liked it when the lake looked like that. A murky lake knew how to keep secrets. The sun, trying to break through ominous purple and gray clouds, was not having much luck. Keith ate the last piece of cold pizza, hoping for rain, heavy rain, that would rile up the algae. Leaning against the headrest, he tipped the bottle of Jack Daniels and sucked the last few drops, needing more, but it was all gone. He wiped his mouth on his sleeve. Fishing the fob key from his pants pocket, he switched on the car ignition to roll down the window and toss the empty pizza carton and half-bitten crust to the ground. The damp air felt cool on his face, but smelled like rotten eggs. He could hear the rhythm of the water lapping against the shore. The comforting sound calmed him enough so his mind could work on his story. I went to Leslie's apartment, but she wasn't there. No, wait. We had dinner at Luigi's, and I dropped her off. That was the last time I saw her. A large black crow in the tall fir next to his car made shrieking sounds, urging him to leave so it could claim the pizza crust. "Gah, gah!" it rasped over and over again. Keith covered his ears, but the continual screeching made his blinding white anger return. He quickly rolled up the window and rested his head against the steering wheel, grateful for the green apple scent coming from the car air freshener. Why couldn't Leslie keep her mouth shut? Why did she always have to be on his case? Gah! 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 He repeatedly stabbed the dashboard with his clenched fist. Shut up! Shut up! He stretched his neck and stared at himself in the rearview mirror, itchy eyes puffed and bloodshot whiskers sprouting on his cheeks. He ran his hand over his brown, close-cropped hair. At least that wasn't messy. Scratched his chest and sniffed his armpits. He needed a warm shower but didn't dare go back to his apartment. Not now. He tried to swallow the metallic taste in his mouth, but it lingered. What was that? A pinging noise hit the roof of the Taurus, turning into a rushing, torrential downpour. The heavy rain had come, washing away the grime on the car's hood. Remember to make eye contact. Be sure to vacuum the trunk. He cracked the window. The crow had disappeared. The air smelled sweeter, innocent even.
G-String Grind by Lori Sandra Davis. Sylvie slid the window open as a blast of cold, wet air slapped her with US 30's diesel fumes. "Yes, sir, what would you like to drink today?" she smiled. In a black Lexus, a businessman, fumbling for his wallet, turned toward the G-String Grind coffee shack, and seeing Sylvie, frowned. He thrust his credit card at her with downcast eyes. "Just a small coffee," he said. Sylvie watched him refuse to meet her eye. That meant no tip. Grinding her teeth, she poured his coffee and ran the card. Sure enough, no tip. When a man went to G-String Grind for coffee, he wanted more than semi-nude. He wanted young. In a bikini, Sylvie couldn't disguise her aging body, shriveled breasts, and sagging belly. As he drove off, she slid the window closed against the pelting rain. Shivering in a cheap pink bikini, in a lavender-colored coffee shack, in a gray Portland winter, no longer paid the red collection notices. Tips went to the young. Even to Sylvie, the 20-year-olds who staffed the shack during peak hours seemed like ripe fruit in their bikinis, lingerie, and undies. At 39, her own breasts looked like fallen apricots left to rot. Without customer tips, all she had was minimum wage. She calculated how short she would be on the rent in 3 days. Elbows propped on the counter, Sylvie gazed at the traffic on US 30. This was the road out of town. Traffic either went south to Portland or north to Astoria. In this neighborhood, the only reason to stop was business at the hazardous waste disposal site, appreciating a scenic view of petroleum tanks, or getting coffee from a scantily clad girl. In Sylvie's case, a hard done by old stripper. At least when she was stripping, the money poured in. Then she could afford plenty of clothes for her daughter. Now even Mary's Club wouldn't hire an exotic dancer past her prime. Knowing she shouldn't, Sylvie stooped to reach her cell phone. Choosing a number, she pressed call. "Hi, Susan, it's me, Mommy," she chirped. "What do you want?" "Just to say hi, sweetheart." Sylvie caressed the red plastic phone at her cheek. "Olivia says she hasn't received a check from you." "Yeah, my tips ain't too good lately." "Ma, I need clothes. Olivia says if you don't cough up, she's sending me back to foster care." "Honey, I'm not sure when I'll have more cash." Click. Sylvie stared at the cheap plastic phone. Her heart hurt like a bruise. Damn, Olivia. Susie had one more semester of high school and then she'd be out on her own. Now the only thing Sylvie had left to give her daughter was something Susie didn't want. Sighing, she ground beans, poured them into the reserve coffee maker, then topped off and reorganized the syrup bottles. As she hefted supplies onto a high shelf, Sylvie noticed a picture postcard tucked under the molding and plucked it down. A trucker gave it to her with his tip. The photograph, shot from a hill, looked down at the Astoria Bridge where the Columbia met the Pacific. According to the trekker, there was a bar across the mouth of the river, underwater, that caused 2,000 shipwrecks. Sylvie'd never been there, didn't have time for pleasure trips. She imagined herself on the Astoria Bridge, then beyond the bridge, flying, clean ocean spray on her face. A trucker pulled up to the window. She slid the glass aside and gave him her sexiest smile. His eyes traveled slowly from her crotch to her breast. How the f*** am I supposed to get off looking at those shriveled things? He slapped the wheel and gunned his engine. Sylvie watched him go, her smile sliding away with the fumes. She sank heavily onto a low stool below the window. Throat tight, eyes moist. She remembered how men used to look at her. Thick red hair and a porcelain complexion. Pretty had always been her job description. Squatting near the floor heater, she remembered the first time a man looked at her with indifference. It was in her last days at Dancing Bear. A jerk looked right past her as if she wasn't shimmying until her breast ached. The mid-afternoon crowd trickled through, bringing men in hard hats who poured concrete nearby. Near closing, the manager pulled up in a battered panel truck. He tapped on the door. "Hey, Joe, what do you know?" An old joke worn thin. "Hey, Syl," Joe said, unsmiling. "You done real good work here, but I told you from the start I didn't know how long I could keep you." Joe was an old customer. When she'd asked for a job, he'd done what he could. Now he handed her a final paycheck, $372.11. Not enough to make the rent. "I'll close for you." Sylvie pulled on her jeans and t-shirt, then slipped the Astoria Bridge postcard into her purse. Hood over hair, she tramped through the dark, rain, and sucking mud to her old Ford Fiesta deep in the weeds. She started the car, waited to get warm, and tucked the postcard in the sun visor band. She drove toward the St. John's Bridge, then waited to ascend the hill to the entrance. Across the Willamette, her studio apartment waited. Now she'd have 3 final days to enjoy it. Through pouring rain, Sylvie watched the red stoplight and listened to the rhythm of the left turn signal. Her Fiesta rocked every time a car sped by heading toward Astoria. She stared at the postcard, now red in the dashboard lights. She could almost hear seagulls flying past the bridge out to sea. The ocean spray on her face would feel so cool, so cleansing. Flipping the turn signal from left to right, she checked over her shoulder for traffic and turned into the right lane, the one to Astoria.
Guardian by Rebecca Haas. The station wagon's engines, going faulty, were driving 25 miles per hour on the right side of the highway, half in the slow lane, half on the shoulder. Mom's got both hands clenched on the steering wheel, leaning over the dashboard like she's urging the car forward with sheer will. The car moves in rhythmic gasps, pausing in between the surges, catching its breath. Mom whispers, quiet so the little ones can't hear. "Pat, Pat, Pat, this is Pat." She turns to me and says, "I've got the gas pedal pushed all the way to the floor. Like, can you believe this sh-?" We're just outside of Gainesville, Florida, headed back home to Cincinnati. For 10 years since my brother Kevin was born, we've gone on family vacation to Florida. Mom said it'd be no different this summer, even after the divorce. But we didn't go to the coast where we used to go when Dad was with us. We went to Central Florida, to Ocala, where Mom's sister, Florence, lives. "You're crazy driving 4 kids down to Florida by yourself," Flo said. The air coming in the car windows feels like steam from a hot shower and smells like Kevin's farts. Sweat has my bare thighs glued to the pleather front seat. Baby is asleep on the quilt in the way back. My sister Kate is sprawled out on her stomach over most of the back seat, reading Mom's book, Flowers in the Attic, which she shouldn't be reading because she's only 8. Behind me, Kevin is squished against the door so no part of his body will touch Kate's skin. His feet dancing a jig on the back seat, the back of my seat. Christ, he's even more neurotic than Nick, Flo said. If that's possible, she said. It must be 100 degrees, Kevin says. He wears swim goggles with blue tinted lenses. He refuses to take them off. No complaining, Mom says. Her white t-shirt is soaked through with sweat. Underneath, her red bra glows like a neon sign. You've still got great tits, Flo says. You'll find another man. The station wagon takes one last lurch and rolls to a stop, mostly on the shoulder of the road. Mom lays her head down on the steering wheel, not saying anything. Kate sits up and looks around. On either side of the highway, for as far as we can see, there is marsh. Lily pads floating in black water, clumps of tall shrubby trees. We all stare at Mom's bowed head. A fat mosquito lands on my thigh and draws blood before I can smack it dead. Mom, I'm praying, she says. I glance back at Kevin and Kate. Mom sits up and turns to face us. Minor setback. She smiles a tight little smile. I'll catch a ride to a gas station and find someone to come and fix the car. We'll all go, I say. She looks at me. And who's going to happen by with enough spare seats for a ragtag family of 5? Flo calls us that, ragtag, only she says it in a nice way. Watch out for alligators, says Kevin, and snakes and piranha. Mom sighs, picks through her purse. Stay in the car, keep the doors locked. She hands the keys to me and opens the car door. That's when we see him, walking towards us, along the shoulder of the highway. A man with hair so long it touches his waist. Brown hair stained gold by the sun. He's wearing nothing but a thick blanket wrapped around his bony torso, a wool toga. He lifts a newspaper from under his arm and opens it wide like it's a fine thing to read the daily news while taking a stroll along the highway. After about 10 paces, he reaches up and tears a long strip from the paper and holds it high above his head in the air. He lets go. The torn piece floats like a streamer, twirling and twisting with the air. The man screams and jerks as if under assault by a swarm of bees. The blanket drifts away from his body, and we glimpse the triangle of dark hair at his crotch. He reaches up and tears off another strip. Mom's standing in front of the car, hand on her forehead like a visor. When the man screams out a second time, she hurries back inside. A squeal comes from Kevin like a dog's whine. With both hands, he furiously winds up his window. He's not wearing underpants, Kate says. Mom turns the key in the ignition. The car quivers and then goes still. Oh no, Kevin cries. Oh no, oh no. Mom glances up at her image in the rearview mirror. She blinks in slow motion. When she turns back towards us, her face is soft. She kneels on the seat, facing the rear of the car. She reaches down and squeezes Kevin's hand, motions Kate to come closer. I think God has answered my prayers. He sent an angel to watch over us. We look from her to the man. He's finished tearing the paper. He's walking towards us in a straight line, practically marching, long hair streaming out behind him like a cape. Mom doesn't bother to turn and look. She's watching us, watching our expressions change from fear to wonder.
Lunch Monitor by Elizabeth Danick. From her assigned area near the gym, Caroline could see that the little boy, perhaps a second grader, struggled with the outside vending machine. He reached the selection button easily, but he could not extract the ice cream bar, which was set at least 2 heads higher than his own. She hurried over. Lunch Monitor was a dumb job, but it was good for her high school resume. That and Christian service at the convalescent home and after-school traffic control, but she hated the orange scrimmage pennies tied at the hips and the reflector tape across her breasts in a large X. Next time, push a bench over, she suggested. The bell warning rang. I tried, but I can't do that alone, he declared, as if it were Caroline's fault. Seagulls from the harbor swooped down to peck at chips and fight over sandwich crusts. She recognized the boy's long, dark face as one of the Camillos. He probably the youngest of a brood, his older brother Ralph in her class. Ralph, who said to her yesterday, you have peach fuzz under your nose. In front of Lucy and Roxy Caracciolo, twins, everyone wanted to be, with olive skin and honey hair and hazel eyes. Let's see what we have here, she said, and peered into the dispensary tray and saw a butt of a chocolate ice cream sandwich. The boy's head bobbled below her elbow. Sorry, kid, machine's broken, she said. You better go to class. Across the asphalt playground, Sister Agatha stood outside her classroom door and waved. His classmates had lined up, and they, too, stared in her direction, some of their small hands flitting like sparrow wings. The final bell rang. Go on, you can get your money back tomorrow. The boy looked at her, at the nun, at the vending machine. Bitch, he muttered, then ran, his navy blue trousers hanging from his belted waist like bunched curtains. Caroline waited until the boys' class disappeared onto the patio, then into their room. She removed the ice cream bar and unwrapped it, careful not to peel away the damp chocolate cookie crust. She liked to lick the sides first, waiting for the ice cream to melt a little, then feel the chocolate skin thick against her teeth. The eighth grade science teacher, Miss McCarty, knew that Caroline was a lunch monitor and that she would be 5 minutes late to take the poor box of unwanted red apples and dry pretzels to the convent side door. The sweetness of garden roses surrounded the girl. The oldest nun in a blue apron opened the door. She blinked into the light, took the box with chafed hands, thanked the girl perfunctorily, and quickly closed the door. Sometimes Sister Benina invited lunch monitors in for cocoa, but it was too hot out. Maybe nuns never drink cokes. She faced the hazy October light and wondered, if she opened her eyes, could the sun really burn her retinas? Why do seagulls have infrared vision and not I? And why, she wondered too, when you really love something, you close your eyes as if you're going to kiss it, melt with it. Miss McCarty stood the stairwell, her parapet before class, dusting her own chin of crumbs, pouring coffee from a thermos into a cup. She motioned for Caroline to hurry. There would be a quiz on atoms and states of matter, material Caroline thought she knew blindfolded. The girl savored the last melted bit of chocolate cream and licked her lips, warm against a cold tongue, which she wiped over her cuspids and incisors. She brushed away the sticky remains from the corners of her mouth and touched her upper lip for peach fuzz and found a sticky spot. Tomorrow she would give the little brat a quarter, and today she would trip Ralph when he stepped over her books on his way to the restroom, and she would mutter, butt breath, each time he passed, hoping, eyes closed, he might notice her again.
Sunday, Fun Day by Beth Fernandez. Dale is sitting up reading the news when I wake. All discipline is self-discipline, he tells me over his reading glasses when I moan I drank too much the night before. My head feels like something too large is growing under my skull and I can't get out. The painkiller kicks in while I sip my coffee, but I can still feel a throb parallel to my left temple. I mix myself a Bloody Mary. It's Sunday, Fun Day. What I really need is brunch. I call Andrea, but her kid has a soccer game. Wendy is on a diet, so she doesn't want to drink or eat. She invites me on a hike with her and Allison. They didn't invite me in the first place, even though I would have declined. The French door has crab Benedict and celery-infused Bloody Marys, which is what I'm craving. Parker is always up for fun, but he's 86 from the French door for mistaking a storage room for the toilet. I begrudgingly meet him at Steelhouse for bottomless mimosas. What happened to working in the yard? Dale asks as I put on my jacket. Oh, I forgot. I had plans with Parker. I lie. It's just brunch. It won't be long. Parker is already at the bar when I arrive. He tries to kiss me with his thick stubble, but I pull away because he smells worse than the beer-soaked wood floors. Did you sleep here last night? I ask. He laughs, takes a sip of his half-empty mimosa, and asks me when I became such a CU next Tuesday. Where's stale? Parker asks. He'd prefer the gym to brunch, I say. We both roll our eyes and toast. I want to dance. Oh, let's go dancing, I plead. I want to raise my arms in the air and dance so hard the back of my hair gets sweaty. Not on a Sunday afternoon, honey, he says. Not even the gay bars have dancing on Sunday afternoons. Ah, the modern gay man is a bore, I say. You included. A group sits down at the table behind us in a blur of black clothes and coal eyeliner. A young blonde in skinny jeans catches both our eyes. His ponytail is a mess, and his pale face is as pretty as it gets without being too feminine. He sees me see him. I think I love him, I say to his face. He reads my lips and smiles. Honestly, Parker, I say when I turn around to the bar, I love him. I drink my mimosa down and he pours me another from the rapidly disappearing pitcher. Dream on, old lady, Parker sighs. I look back again. A girl with pink hair and multiple piercings paws at him. I imagine the two of them twisted up together like a churro. I despise her. He watches me watch her with his big blue eyes and his granite face. Wisps of soft hair fall from his ponytail. I regret not wearing sexier shoes. I wish I had the money to buy him, I say. When I turn back to the bar, I want to own him. You can't own a butterfly, Parker says. It's 1 o'clock and you already have a fat tongue, I say out of revenge. Don't be bitter, he chides. Have another drink. There is no way back to my youth. It's a lost piece of jewelry that I keep hoping will show up again. Someone else wears it now. I'll bet no one asked him to stay home and pick weeds, I say, thinking of Dell on a treadmill, reading the Wall Street Journal from his phone. Drinking makes me want to smoke. On the way out the door, I flash a joint toward the blonde. He flashes his white teeth when he smiles. I've already had 2 hits when he appears. I pass the joint and he leans against the wall and takes a hit. Thanks for sharing, he says, with a smile. I grew up myself. I say, it's organic. Sounds so stupid. Like the time I met Bono and could only manage to say, you're awesome. Are you a grower? He asks with real curiosity. Yes, I lie. I have a small farm. He's so young and beautiful, and I say so. The last few words got tangled up in my inebriated tongue, and I giggle. I'm 27, he says, smiling. I used to be quite the pretty boy, but I've lost my glow. You think 27 is old? I laugh. Well, it's almost 30. I'm almost 40, and not in 3 years either. More like 3 months. I drink to find my glow. The pawing girl comes out of the bar. She smiles sweetly at me as he hands her the joint. Her face is creamy and she has his voice like cotton candy. She's a grower, he tells her. I still don't know his name. Coo, she says. Her skin is polished marble, her stomach flat in low-rise jeans. Organic, I tell her. I hear it's hard to get into the business, she says. How'd you do it? All discipline is self-discipline, I say. He watches me look her over, and maybe he thinks I'm jealous, but I'm not. They stand against the heavy door tie while I've already moved through it. My eyes are heavy, and I don't feel like dancing anymore. There's another full pitcher at the bar when I return. Oh, I still love him, I say. You know what your problem is? Parker asks and then answers his own question. You're addicted to youth. We toast to thick hair and smooth thighs.
Mm-hmm. Shame, also a noun. The painful feeling of having done something dishonorable or improper. Disgrace, a cause for regret or disappointment. Oh, that self-righteous internal lecture usually starts with a simple question. What the f- Then disbelief. What was I thinking? Moving to self-preservation. Maybe no one will know. And then soul-crushing doubt. Why am I wearing somebody else's pants? Shame.
Marina by Amreen Ukani. It's the night of our high school graduation, and Marina and I are, as usual, at a party. I don't know whose party it is. Marina finds the parties and I go to them. We are great at parties. We are beautiful and young and drunk and slutty. Or maybe we're terrible at parties and we just don't care. We don't need anyone else. Only now I've lost Marina, or at least given up on finding her. I'm sitting on a couch, curled up, looking at my phone, when a guy sits down next to me and hands me a drink. Couldn't have you sitting here all lost and empty-handed, he says. That's okay, I'll get a drink later. Roofie free, I guarantee. He takes a gulp from the cup and holds it out. I'm Mike, he says, when I take it. I'm sure I've met him before, but I don't know where. He puts his drink between his legs so he can gesture with large, quick hands while we talk. He keeps leaning in close to me when I speak, and I'm not surprised when he kisses me. When he goes to the kitchen for more drinks, I remember that he has a girlfriend, but I really don't care. He's back seconds later without drinks. You need to go to the balcony, he says. Marina is slumped against the railing, throwing up and crying. She slides down to the ground bonelessly, and I crouch beside her. She's clammy and pale, hair stuck to the side of her face. I push the damp strands back and hold her, ignoring the vomit next to her and flecked, I'm sure, on her clothes. She scoots away from me and curls herself up, leaning against the railing. The first thing she says is that she saw my mom earlier that day, which explains a lot. There's an acceptance letter from the University of Georgia tacked up on my fridge, and I start a summer freshman program in a week. I have told Marina none of this. She hasn't yet applied anywhere. The applications I printed out for her myself sitting still on her dresser. Let me take you home, I say. She will forget this tomorrow. We'll wake up in her bed and she'll pretend this didn't happen and I'll let her. And when I tell her I'm leaving, she'll pretend she didn't know. We're good at pretending when we need to. The overhead lamp catches the tears on her cheeks. Her face is stripped with light. Perfect, except for the redness around her eyes. She wipes her face. UGA, huh? I thought you'd at least make it out of state. I am used to this. When Marina is hurt, she is as vicious and hissing as a cornered animal. It is my job to coax her, but today I can't. I thought you'd make it with me, I say. Guess we're both wrong. She wobbles to her feet, shaking off the hand that I can't help but put out to catch her. Don't worry, I'm sure you'll make lots of new friends in your sorority. She comes towards me, hand on the wall to support herself. She only makes it a few steps. I kneel beside her and hold her, the wood floor of the balcony digging into my kneecaps. I find Mike. Can you help me get her into the bathtub? He carries her to the bathroom. I turn on the shower and let it rush over her. She jerks once when it first hits her, but then she's still. I sit on the ledge of the bathtub and wipe her face with a washcloth. The cold water strikes my arm and shoulder in an unrelenting tattoo. When I feel my arm go numb, I turn the water off and hold my breath until Marina twitches and gurgles. Mike puts his hand on my shoulders when I stand up. I had forgotten he was there. My world narrowed, as usual, to Marina and me. He kisses the back of my neck, closes the door to the bathroom, and slides a hand inside my bra. The light over the mirror pulses bright. I look at Marina, beached in the bathtub. Mike turns me around so that we both face the mirror away from her. He puts his hand around my neck, moves it over my collarbones and down my chest. Marina's reflection looms in the bottom corner of the mirror. I cannot escape it. Her hair is matted to her cheek and shoulder, and her skin is vaguely green in the fluorescent light. Mike pulls me harder against him, erection, pressing against my lower back, and runs his thumbs along the inside edge of my waistband. In the bathtub, Marina shifts and moans some lost, half-swallowed sound. I flee for the door, pushing through the still crowded living room. Before I leave, I can't help it. I look back. Through the space and the bodies, all I see is Mike, already turning around, closing the bathroom door behind him.
Birthday by Anna S. King. She found the room, slightly regretting that it couldn't be trapped by the stink of nicotine. Not that she smoked anymore, but back then cigarettes had been a shared stubborn hold on an acceptable addiction, along with guzzling sour urn coffee made thick with spoonfuls of sugar. In those days of styrofoam, she'd score the minutes into her cup as she'd sweated through the rituals, the stories, the fears of her telling her own. There was still the chalkboard and hymnal scent of a church basement, as common to meetings as the crappy seating. This one had the metal ass killer chairs, but better those than the sunken donated love seats with the rolled edges of upholstery as picked over as her cups once were. She hoped to avoid being greeted without luck.
Hi, are you new? May I help you?
A novice 12-stepper sparkling with spiritual purpose. No, thanks. I'm just here for the birthday meeting.
Well, we are definitely giving out chips tonight. Sounds like you've been here before. Which step are you on?
I'm not really working the steps right now.
Oh.
The disappointment evident on her young face.
Well, I'm certainly not going to work your program, but you know it works if you work it.
I'm okay. The first step works pretty well for me.
Well, I'm sure you know what a dry drunk is. There's tea and coffee in the back.
And flounced off to spread the word. That's how it started. Whether it was pearls or an ankle tracker that trembled with the shakes, everyone knew was set on the same path. When she'd stumbled over her own feet coming into her first meeting, she desperately wanted them to know she was just clumsy, not drunk. But like tonight, there was someone who smiled all too knowingly while handing her pamphlets, pointing her to the smoking section, showing her the ropes that would pull her out, but eventually tie her down. I admitted I was powerless, she thought to herself, as settled in near the back next to a door. She'd been unmanageable, deeply defective, resigned to turning her will over to another. She'd dutifully done the 90 meetings in 90 days, then for years worked the steps, made her amends, done countless fearless inventories. It was all in the service of erasing sulfuric memories of finishing the drinks of strangers before waiters cleared them, the tables, of counting out pennies for a beer at the corner store, the not-so-subtle sniffs at the fumes rising from her skin. The meeting started. The rote of one volunteer reading the steps, another the traditions, both pages laminated for years of use. Then someone told a story. It was theirs, but familiar.
Thank you for sharing. Keep coming back, the leader exclaimed. He pulled a plastic box from under his chair. Okay, since it's the first meeting of the month, we're handing out chips. Who has 24 hours?
Everyone clapped. Once. An old man rose, reaching out a sun-scarred hand for his plastic wafer. This was not his first communion, she thought, and knew but for the grace of God. This was why she'd embraced the recitations, to avoid the mornings of hot blushes, wondering who was beside her, where she'd left the car, why the furniture was broken, the origins of bruises. Mea culpa. I am faulty. I have sinned. I will make amends. I will let go and let God. I will work the steps until they work me. I admit forever my shortcomings.
She could accept she was powerless with all her heart, but her powerless was with vodka, to the teeth-staining cheap red wines, to bottom-shelf gin. The expected lifetime of self-recrimination, the shallow reliance on a higher power, eventually felt like a hair shirt. Replacing mortifying drunkenness with mortification of self eventually drove her from these rooms. But she was safe only in embracing that she was forever a drunk. So she brought herself back once a year to join in service to sobriety.
Does anyone have a week? 5 years?
No one rose.
More than five? I have seen 7 years this week.
Pats on the back, the coin held high.
10 years?
People cheered. They'd expected him to rise. A regular. Cringing in dread. But she was always just one sip from disaster. The anniversary must be marked in order for the days to keep adding up.
More than 10 years?
More than 20? The clap. Less enthusiastic. People were restless to leave. She raised her hand.
Let's move on. Oh, I didn't see you. Stand up. How many years are you celebrating?
She took a deep breath.
30. I have 30 years, she said.
Her vision tunneled to his hand digging through the box as she walked past, the gasps, the whispers.
Who is that?
Some hands brushed against her hem as if there might be a blessing of longevity. She forgave herself for the ungracious thought of knowing the greeter was doing the math. That's right, Missy. I've been sober longer than you've been alive. The leader found the coin just as she reached him and placed it in her palm. She only smiled at his sincere congratulations, knowing her voice would crack if she spoke.
Metal,
because it was more than a year. She pressed her thumb over the triple X numerals, smugly appreciating the little sacrilege. He asked, since this is a big day for you, would you lead our closing prayer? She could make this small sacrifice to sobriety, the coin heating between her hand and his as they joined in a circle, saying the words together. Even in her cynicism, even as she skipped over saying the word God, she embraced her annual acceptance. This program, whether because or despite the eternal circles of remorse, had saved her.
Inner Leaps by Raymond Mitchell. Big Martha just did it, and without a lot of fanfare. Listen, if a 5'4", 235-pound woman in her late 40s can do it, then so can I, right? Besides, if I don't do it here, I'll never do it anywhere. For 3 days, that's been my mantra, along with endlessly perseverating over how the hell to make my jump look good. Maybe I can do it without actually having to look down. Just a little backward push off, and then a lean forward into an inward dive. How hard can it be? Problem is, I can't even make it off your basic 2-foot-high diving board. Not head first, anyway. My turn next? Oh God, what if I pee in my pants on the way down? My wife, June, didn't sign up for this gig. Way too scary for her. But she came along anyway. Says she wants to watch me. On the drive up here, we kept a steady eye on Masha, the Israeli guy who looked like he might throw up any minute. Meanwhile, Martha politely put up with Jonathan's endless blabber about how terrific his jump is going to be and how great he'll look in the video. I mostly chatted with Madison, a nervous slip of a girl who looked to be maybe 16 years old. She's going to do it this time for sure, even if it kills her. She tried her best, twice actually, but her legs froze up solid. They count out loud to 5 and then you're supposed to jump. If you chicken out, you get 2 more chances. After that, just walk away in shame. Don't even get your $75 back. Both times, Madison used her father's credit card, so he made her promise she'd never try this again. Stubborn girl, huh? This morning, our Land Rover lurched up the pitted, rock-strewn road from Queenstown like a roller coaster, inching its way up the steep track to that first god-awful crest. A sure setup for things to come. Still, this is the place to do it. New Zealand, where all this insanity started. Pipeline is the highest bungee jump in the Southern Hemisphere. Obviously, I need to prove something to myself. First thing they do when they get you here is weigh you. That's important. It tells them how much cord they need to give you so you'll pull up before crushing your skull. Of course, it'd be great to just lightly touch a finger to the water. But, well, that's why I bought one of those Maori pendants that look like fancy fish hooks. The sales tag said they're good for safe passage over water. We're on this narrow footbridge that hovers 335 feet above the raging yet disturbingly shallow waters of the Chateauvre River. Jane's still hanging out with ashen-faced Masha, trying to give him permission to throw in the towel, I suppose. God only knows why he wants to do this thing. Madison's up next. I give her a big thumbs up, but it doesn't seem to help. Still, on her second countdown, she shakes her long blonde hair, takes a huge breath, and disappears over the side. Really? My turn next? An absurdly smiling, well-tanned Kiwi fellow is fastening a harness tight around my ankles. To this, he connects the bungee cord, an inch and a half thick tubing made out of zillions of puny rubber strands. Who knew? Looking up, I can see myself in the overhead mirror next to the video camera. The morning mist has matted down my hair. I look like a drowned rat. Come on, say something brave. After all, this could be the last thing anyone hears from me. Kiwi says I'm not allowed to have anything on my body that could possibly fall off during the jump. If it got loose, it could cleave right through anyone standing on the riverbank below. That means no pendant. Well, screw that. I'm tying it to a belt loop and hiding it in my pocket. Sometimes you just have to have something, anything to hold on to. Nearby, June is leaning her face into the Israeli guy's slumping body. It's rescue time. Wish someone would rescue me. Besides, just how am I supposed to get over to the jump point with my feet all tied up? Oh God, now Kiwi's telling me not to look down and he's already started the countdown. One, no time to set up for a fancy dive. Two, this is suicide. Three, nobody does this unless they want to die. Four, I don't want to die. Five, please, please don't let me pee in my pants. Can't I have a six? No six. Only silence and then a split second of sheer terror as my treasonous legs catapult me into what I vaguely imagine a swan dive might look like. But I'm free. Nothing left to do but fly, like in a dream. Feels like floating. Some inner Tarzan screams nonstop in ecstasy. Down, down, till I'm as stretched out as the damn cord. Then back up again, weightlessly, down, and so on until, regrettably, it's all over. And they haul my dangling body over to the riverbank and remove my rubber lifeline. I'm supercharged. As is Madison. Jabbering with mutual elation, we almost miss seeing Masha's dive. Amazing, he did it. Together, we rush over to congratulate him, but his cowering eyes tell us that he's still shackled by fear. He's hated every single minute of his reckless folly. What can we say? But now for ultra-confident Jonathan, who's generously saved the best for last. Craning our necks, we gaze up at his proud posture before his knees buckle and he simply collapses over the side. Afterward, he refuses to speak to any of us. Doesn't stick around to pick up his videotape either. Time now to put the Maori pendant back around my neck. I bloody own it.
That was Liars League PDX, recorded here at Literary Arts in May 2017. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.